Thanks very much, Stuart, and it's great to be here. Actually, this place has really good memories for me. Looking around the room, I rather doubt if any of you would have been here, but 30 years ago, I got married, and I'm still married. We're celebrating our 30th anniversary in about 3 weeks' time. And as part of our wedding service, we had some very creative people in the church who wrote a kind of musical come drama to perform during our wedding service, which is a long story which I won't go into, but it was great fun. It was kind of unusual to have this sort of performance going on in the middle of your wedding service. But we so enjoyed it, and there were one or two friends there from different churches, and we ended up being asked to do it here. I don't, as I say, suspect that any of you were here, but it kind of reminds me, Alma always reminds me of my wedding. So there you are. It's a nice association to have with here. I've been back on other occasions, but that one kind of stands out. Yes, Stuart asked me if I would speak on leadership, and what a vast kind of subject. I wasn't quite sure what to choose. There's all sorts of things we could pick out about leadership, and as he says, he's described a little bit of something of the turmoil that you've been going through in leadership, and I kind of made an association in my mind, having talked about marriage, and I was thinking about Paul's writing on the subject in Ephesians. And he draws a very close parallel. He talks about marriage, and then he talks about the church, and he says, it's a bit of a mystery, he says, but actually the church is the bride of Christ, and there's a kind of symmetry, there's a parallel between marriage and the church, and Jesus' relationship with the church. And the connection in my mind was simply this, that after 30 years of marriage, I realized that conflict is normal. I'm sure that that may not be true in yours, but certainly is in mine, that it's not that we fight every day, but that in any relationship, and particularly in relationships where you care and where you're committed, then you are inevitably going to have to work out your differences together. And so the key thing is not that we'll never have any difficulties. The key thing is, what will we do in the light of the difficulties that we have? And it's with that in mind that I thought I'd talk about leadership today. It's when there have been and are difficulties, what do we do as a result? How do we respond? So, I doubt whether I'm going to say anything particularly new and profound, despite what Stuart said about me this morning. But what I want to do is to take a passage of Scripture that is extremely familiar and look at some ingredients that I see of Jesus' leadership and how that might apply to us today. And it's John chapter 13, and it's a story where at this famous meal, Jesus washes the disciples' feet. So I'll read it through and then make some comments from it. John chapter 13. It was just before the Passover feast. Jesus knew that the time had come for him to leave this world and go to the Father. Having loved his own who were in this world, he now showed them the full extent of his love, which I find an intriguing point, incidentally, both in terms of its immediate reference to what he then got up and did, but also, of course, recognizing that whenever Jesus said and did things, it all also was pointing forwards to what he was facing and about to do in terms of the cross and the resurrection. But that's what John wrote. He now showed them the full extent of his love. The evening meal was being served, and the devil had already prompted Judas Iscariot, son of Simon, to betray Jesus. So the context is, obviously, change. Jesus is more than aware that things are on a knife edge. They've reached the watershed. Big change and also conflict. Jesus knew that the Father had put all things under his power and that he'd come from God and was returning to God. You know, just, we all know the story. We know what's coming, don't we? But just pause for a moment. Having set this scene, this next action could easily lose its force on us. That here's a man under immense pressure, aware that he's about to face an enormous trial in a setting with his friends who should be and are for him, except for one who seems to have buckled under the pressure. And you would think, having recognized that a common courtesy had been ignored, which was washing feet, normal custom, you know, people with dirty feet not wearing shoes and socks, the servant would have automatically washed feet but hadn't done so. Maybe the servant wasn't there. And none of the disciples had bothered to do it for whatever reasons, which were not told. Maybe they thought it was beneath them. Whatever. Maybe they just thought, like many of us think, well, somebody else will do it. But whatever the reason, they hadn't. And in that setting, you'd have thought that Jesus would have said, somebody needs to serve me. I'm under huge pressure. Someone should come to my rescue, as it were. Someone should at least extend some service to me. I'm facing the greatest trial of all time. But he doesn't. And what he does is take the initiative, and we'll continue. So he got up from the meal, took off his outer clothing, wrapped a towel around his waist. After that, he poured water into a basin, began to wash his disciples' feet, drying them with the towel that was wrapped around him. And he came to Simon Peter, who said to him, Lord, are you going to wash my feet? And Jesus replied, you do not realize now what I'm doing, but later you will understand. No, said Peter, you'll never wash my feet. Jesus answered, unless I wash you, you have no part with me. Then Lord, Simon Peter replied, not just my feet, but my hands and my head as well. And Jesus answered, a person who's had a bath needs only to wash his feet. His whole body is clean, and you are clean, though not every one of you. For he knew who was going to betray him, and that was why he said, not everyone was clean. And when he'd finished washing their feet, he put on his clothes and returned to his place. And he said again, do you understand what I've done for you? You call me teacher and Lord, rightly so, for that is what I am. And now that I, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also should wash one another's feet. I've set you an example that you should do as I have done for you. I tell you the truth, no servant is greater than his master, nor is a messenger greater than the one who sent him. And now that you know these things, you'll be blessed if you do them. So, what I want to say about leadership, coming out of this passage, some things that Jesus' example, I think, speaks to us about. And I'm speaking to all of us, really, because I'm coming from the point of view that every Christian is called to exercise leadership in some sphere of our life. If you think about Matthew 28, Jesus said to all his disciples, including us, go into the world and make a difference. Go into the world and make disciples. Go into the world and bring about change. So that's all of us. No one's excluded. There are spheres of leadership, but we're all called to it. And it's with that in mind I want to make these comments about Jesus. First thing I want to say is this, and it comes back to this point. He got up from the meal, took off his outer clothing, wrapped a towel round his waist, and he washed their feet. And it's simply this, that when change is needed, which it always is, but when change is needed in key relationships, the place to start, Jesus demonstrates, is always with me. And the temptation is always to feel that change should start with the other person or with somebody else. You may have heard this illustration. I heard it so long ago I can't reference it. I can't remember where it came from. But read it in a book. It's a story of some kind of naval exercise that was taking place in NATO, I suspect, off the coast of the United States. And various ships were maneuvering, and at some point or another during this maneuver, one of the ships spotted another ship that was out of position, its lights were ahead, and so it started signaling, basically saying, because of our positioning, you need to move to whichever the etiquette is on the sea. I have no idea, but anyway, you move port or starboard, but basically get out of the way because I'm a big ship and I'll run you over. Anyway, it didn't. This light remained where it was, signaled back, but it didn't move. And so the captain, commander, signals again, and a lot stronger language, but basically you need to move out of the way. We are a whatever it was, probably an aircraft carrier. I have no idea. And if you've heard this story, you will know that the punchline is eventually this light ahead signaled back and said, no, you move out of the way. I am a lighthouse. And I suppose, I heard a very similar illustration, very different context. The day before yesterday, I was driving through Bristol. I'm a bit of a radio addict. And I was listening to Woman's Hour, good program. And Jenny Murray, I think it is. Is she the one with the silky voice? Yeah. She was interviewing Harry Benson. If you know Harry Benson, he's a great man. He's based here in Bristol. And he runs an organization that is designed to prepare people, basically, for relationships and for marriage or whatever cohabiting relationship you have. But he runs courses to enable and to skill people to stick together. And he's written a book about it. He was on this program talking about it. And Jenny Murray was drawing out his own story and his own story of almost losing his marriage and then putting it back together again, and how he came to set up this organization and eventually write this book. And she was saying to him, so what, in the end, what did you do? You know, what did you have to do in order to rescue your relationship? And it was an interesting discussion because he didn't answer the question. And she pressed him. But in the end, basically, he said simply this. He said, he alluded to various things that can block a relationship from prospering or flourishing. Not least the tendency either to fight or to fly, you know, not to negotiate and not to actually communicate, but to go to one extreme or the other. But he says in the end, he said the key thing was to realize that if I want my marriage to change, I've got to change. And if I take responsibility, then that is the most important first step. And I see that in Jesus, actually. I mean, of all people, he was the least least needed to get up and wash feet. But he did. He took the initiative. So it's extremely countercultural. And I think in the context where I know, as a church, you've had these difficulties that Stuart was referring to with leadership and change, and the kind of disappointments and real responses that generates in us, we need to be countercultural in our response. As I say, conflict is normal. It's how we respond to it that either causes us to grow up and flourish or become more damaged by what happens. And if you're a football fan, In fact, you only need to be a human being to know that World Cup is taking place at the moment. And it's been interesting to see the reaction to England's demise, and in particular, the culture that we live amongst. Our culture is a culture of blame, isn't it? And there's a great debate as to whether Capello should remain or not. I've seen quite a lot of blank faces here, so it may not be so many football fans amongst us, but take it from me, it's a big issue for a lot of people. But we don't do that. The change begins with me, and Jesus modeled it. Second point I want to make out of his demonstration here is comes back to his John's introduction. Having loved his own who were in the world, he now showed them the full extent of his love. And if we were to go on reading through these chapters of John, it wouldn't take long before we come to this point where he says to his disciples, you know, I no longer call you servants, I call you friends, because everything of the Father's business that I know, I have been making known to you. So leadership is, and we need to remember this as well, it's actually about friendship. And one of the things that Jesus clearly does in this incident is he gets off the platform and he becomes one of them. And it's important for not just for leaders to know that, but for us as members of the congregation to remember that leadership is actually friendship. It's not in the church primarily a position. And Jesus makes himself very vulnerable, very open. As Stuart said, I've been meeting quite regularly with this group over a few years. And one of the things that, if he's complimenting me on saying wise things, I've been very impressed by Stuart's vulnerability and openness and honesty. Yeah, true. We need that, and actually, again, if we look at our culture, the culture we live amongst, it tends towards the opposite. Our culture tends to try and put people on a pedestal. It's a sort of celebrity culture, isn't it, where we're continually seeking to put people up there somewhere, and then, of course, we knock them down again. But that's not the way Jesus models it. Leadership is about friendship, not a position. And he makes himself vulnerable. And his authority, therefore, is not something that he is imposing on his friends, on his disciples. His authority is something that they give to him. And that's the difference in his leadership authority. So it's non-detached. And I suppose I think that that is one of the hallmarks of, and should be one of the hallmarks of church leadership, is that in this sense, it's unprofessional. You know, in most contexts, leadership should and is encouraged to remain detached. But not in the church. The whole reason that that it matters what we do and what we say and how we behave is because we actually care about people. And actually, leadership in the church is to learn to love others. And that applies to us all. You can't leave it behind at the office. A friend of mine in leadership, a guy called Graham Roberts, he once said to me, he said, you know, he was leading a section of our church at the time. And he said, I woke up one night and I was really worrying about the church. And you get a lot of sleepless nights, actually, whenever you're in responsibility anywhere, don't you? Any parent here? You get a lot of sleepless nights being a parent, and being a parent is being a leader too. But Graham woke up one night and he was worrying about the church, and he thought, I need a team, I need a leadership team. Who else is awake worrying about the church? And he said to me, you know, I realize that it's the people who are worried are the ones who really care. Jesus says, don't worry. So there's a conflict there, isn't there? But we do worry about those that we care about. So, change begins with us, if we're going to be leaders. And leadership in the church is about friendship, not position. And Jesus demonstrates these ingredients. But also, leadership is by example. And I don't know how many talks you've heard in the church, and I hate to think how many talks I've heard, how many sermons, lectures, seminars, goodness knows, conferences, I hate to think. And I don't know how many talks of Jesus the disciples heard, but I'm quite certain that they wouldn't have forgotten what happened this day, and I'm sure that's why John includes it in his gospel. Leadership isn't really about what we say. It becomes who we are and what we do. And I think in the church and in our Christian circles, that's one of the biggest challenges. Certainly for me, the biggest challenge is taking this fantastic truth of the gospel and translating it into my life. Incarnation is what it's called, isn't it? Jesus returns to this again and again, both by example, as we see here, and in what he actually said. So perhaps one of the most powerful and challenging parables that he tells in the Sermon on the Mount is about the so-called wise man and the foolish man, the house on the rock and the house on the sand. But essentially what he's saying is, at the end of that story, he says, the wise man is the one who hears and does. John Ortberg, in one talk I heard him giving, if you've heard of him, church leader in America, he said, he calls it the knowing-doing gap, that we know. The real challenge is the do. Jesus demonstrates that leadership is about doing. And we have a fantastic calling to be a community that models something in our culture and in our world that I'm convinced is more and more desperately needed. And incidentally, being here this morning, I sense this is a really healthy place. I know, as I say, you've been going through difficulties, but healthy church here. Some great signs of life. And isn't it a wonderful thing that God is looking for communities which are characterized by the fact that everybody is welcome? That's an unusual community. Most communities, you have to pay a membership. You have to have some sort of qualification. But Jesus is looking for a community which is open to all and which will welcome anyone in any state at any point of their life. It's a great, great calling to model that kind of community where anyone is welcome. And it's a great calling because we don't have to pretend either. So it's a community that is open and honest. A community where nobody's perfect or pretending to be perfect. That's a great relief too. It's great to be part of something where you can be yourself and being encouraged to be yourself. It's a community of acceptance and transparency, in other words, but it's also a community where unusually, really unusually, anything's possible. Because with God amongst us, anything is possible. I long for us to be that kind of church. And we can be. So leadership begins the change in me. Leadership is about, I'm calling it unprofessional care. It's not a position. It's a friendship. And it's by example. Just looking at time, I want to say a couple more things. You may have heard about a survey that's been done in, I think it began in that massive church of Bill Hybels, Willow Creek, but has then continued on into umpteen churches throughout the United States. And the survey is called Reveal. Have any of you heard of this? It's called Reveal? No? Very interesting, because I think the results when they did it at Willow Creek were quite shocking and have changed the strategy of the church. But basically, what Reveal is about is seeking to try to get from people through survey, through questionnaire, through all sorts of things, what are the things that enable people to grow and mature spiritually as Christians? What things really help and what don't? All sorts of results come out of this. But one of the most intriguing and telling results is simply this, that the longer that you are a Christian, the less of a correlation there is between the amount of church activity you are a part of or not. Now, let me explain that a little bit more. What it showed, or what it shows, is that when you are a young Christian or a new Christian, you need teaching, you need to be involved, you need to be instructed, we need help, we need mentoring, we need discipling, etc. But the longer that you are a Christian, the less of a straight relationship, correlation there is between the amount of, if you like, the amount of teaching you receive and the amount that you grow. It's obvious, really, that that actually the key thing is not what somebody else does to you. The key thing to your spiritual growth is what you do for yourself. When you become mature, in other words, you learn to feed yourself. You learn to do things for yourself. And so that was the results of the Reveal thing, was that it was really showing that this church needed to encourage other things amongst its congregation. There was nothing about this result that was suggesting that gathering is not important. Of course it is. When we gather, we're gathering for prayer, for worship, for encouragement, for all of these things, and of course for relationship. But those things in themselves are not the key to your growth. The growth, as you get on as a Christian, as you mature, there are other things that become more and more vital to your development as a Christian. And they, interestingly, they tried to break down what some of those things were. They won't surprise you, but one of them was simply your own personal disciplines. Another one, key one, was that you're engaged in serving others in some way. Another one was that you have committed relationships of some kind. And another was that the Holy Spirit is involved in your life and you're open to the activity of God. It's a massive survey, it's continuing on. But it was very interesting that at its heart, what it was saying was that we need to do things as we go on as Christians, we will grow as we take initiative ourselves. It's not, we cannot continue to be fed for ourselves. So, leadership takes initiative. Jesus says, do you understand? And I want to finish with a little personal testimony. Has anyone here ever had their feet washed? Yeah, same here. Now and again, because clearly this is not culturally appropriate in our society, is it? It's not something we go around doing. But clearly what Jesus is demonstrating needs to be translated into our culture. But from time to time, I can't, probably on one hand, the number of times somebody has said, I want to wash your feet literally, and has gone ahead and done it. But there's one particular occasion that stands out. And whenever it has happened, I have to tell you, I've always been intensely embarrassed. I thought, oh no. And through my mind go the thought, my feet are smelly. Probably my socks are pretty smelly. I do not want to take them off. And the last thing I want is to have someone washing my feet. It's okay in the Middle East, you know, fine, but not here. But I was in a group, small group, meeting leaders, where one of our leaders turned up, and he was absolutely unwavering. He felt God had said, I want to wash your feet this morning. We were going through hard times at that time. And I had all of those reactions. Oh, no, not again, no. But he wasn't going to be put off. So real embarrassment, take your shoes off, you know, take your socks off. I think one of the women even had tights, so she had to go out and take her tights off. And but then one of our group, who turns out was a doctor, he was even more embarrassed than me. He said, well, wash everyone else's feet, but not mine, because my feet are covered in verrucas. And I'm a doctor. I've tried everything, and I can't get rid of them. And if I put my feet in that water, the chances are I'll spread verrucas to everyone else. This guy wasn't going to be put off. He said, no, it's okay. I'll wash your feet last. So reluctantly he agreed. And so we went through this great palaver, this great performance, and we got through it, and I was kind of relieved. And actually, it was good. I mean, it was humbling. You know, we were humbling ourselves. He certainly was humbling himself. And we had our feet washed. The interesting thing was, about a week later, I met up with this friend, this doctor. He said, you know what? He said, verrucas are all gone. Now, that is not a story to say, now here's the secret for how to get your feet, your verrucas healed. But it stuck with me. That if we want a healthy community, we need to listen to what Jesus is saying and watch what Jesus is doing. And he says to us, do you understand what I'm doing? And he wasn't just talking about feet being washed, was he? He said, look, to Peter, he said, you are clean, but not everyone's clean. And he's always saying, there's more to this than just washing the outside. There's more to this. And there's more to a church's health than just our practical service. There's more to it than that. But as we learn to serve one another, as we exercise leadership in that way, so the whole body is made whole. That's what stuck with me. And Jesus finishes by saying, now that you know these things, you'll be blessed, you'll be happy, you'll be fulfilled if you do them. So let's pray.